Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to What's the Crack. In today's episode, I sit down with Will Bastido, the co-director of the Toronto chapter of Canadian Students for Sensible Drug Policy, or CSSDP. In today's episode, Will and I go deep into psychedelics and find out what's the crack with the new research around psychedelics and mental health, what's the crack with promising new leads on psychedelics and epilepsy, and what's the crack with microdosing. In this episode, if you come across some words and think, hey, what is a 5-HT2T? I can't even say it. What is a 5-HT2C receptor? Fear not, this is a serotonin receptor. If you're then thinking, what's serotonin? Serotonin is a neurotransmitter that is said to regulate mood, behavior, appetite, sleep, and is said to maybe have a link with depression. It is also what these psychedelic drugs that we're talking about in this episode latch onto. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed the episode, and remember to follow up on Twitter at WhatTheCrackPod. Enjoy! Okay, hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of What's the Crack. I'm joined today with Will Bastido from the Canadian Students for Sensible Drug Policy here in Toronto. Will, could you tell me a sentence or two about who you are and what you do?
Sure. I'm a student at University of Toronto, just graduating out of my fourth year, and I'm the director, co-director of the Canadian Students for Sensible Drug Policy chapter in Toronto. My role has largely been as a facilitator for a whole bunch of conferences that have gone on this year, and a few that are coming up, working with psychoactive drugs and the legality largely around psychedelics this year. There's been a lot of excitement, but also cannabis, cannabis activism and cannabis legality and illegality. I'm, I guess, an activist and hopeful researcher moving into the field of drug research and drug policy.
Okay, great. And so what is your degree at the moment on?
Pharmacology and neuroscience.
Okay.
Particularly my focus is around the pharmacology of psychoactives, particularly cannabis, as well as stimulants and psychedelic drugs.
Okay, and I'm assuming that that affects with neuroscience and how it affects with the brain.
Yes, of course, the neuroscience of that, and the potential therapeutic values of these medicines, whether it's for conditions like narcolepsy and ADHD with the stimulants, cannabis, they're saying, cures everything these days. Mm-hmm. Or even with the psychedelics, they're talking about some, broader applications of things like addictions and mood disorders. I'm also particularly interested in some rare forms of epilepsy that it seems like psychedelics might be a promising treatment for as well.
Okay, great. Interesting. And we'll unpack that a little bit later because I want to get into that one. Should we start quite broadly in discussing what is Canadian Students for Sensible Drug Policy, or Students for Sensible Drug Policy as a whole, not me,
Well, as a broader whole, I guess we're a student advocacy organization, largely founded around getting the research that's being done at the universities and the policies that we know would be smart to have as drug policies, and then getting these put into practice. Of course, a big drive in the past for the organization has been cannabis legalization. Of course, in Canada, that's happening now. And it's been interesting because now that we're coming into that stage, as an organization, we're talking, we can become less single-minded, but let's get cannabis legalized, let's get people talking about harm reduction, because now they're talking about it, and now we're starting to get into, you know, what are the therapeutic values of some other drugs we might have overlooked, like the psychedelics, as well as talking about, I guess, what we actually want a legal cannabis framework to look like now that it's happening. And drug policy, and it's a really exciting time in that sense as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm assuming that obviously this is a a chapter, as you yes. call them, yes, in Toronto. Is this the same all over Canada? Is there a lot of chapters?
In the States, there are a whole bunch of chapters, and across Canada, there's a whole bunch of chapters of, I guess, just people getting together, getting organized, and getting excited about drugs.
Yeah, great. And I'm assuming, can anyone set up a chapter?
Yes, so long as you're with the student, so long as you're with the university, you reach out to Desi Pavlova, who would be our... I think the head of, not the chapter, but Student for Sensible Drug Policy as, I guess, an international group. And we have resources that can set you up. We have some funding. We have resources that these people can access. And we have a fairly large network across the country, which can be really handy. I'm looking at going to Vancouver over the summer. And, of course, if I'm going to Vancouver over the summer, I'm going to be doing work with the CSSDP over there because it would be silly not to.
Okay, and when did you first get involved with the CSSDP?
So we had back, I guess it would be 3 years ago, there was the first Mushrooms conference with CSSDP run by Daniel Grigg, who moved mountains for the organization. He's okay. taking a bit of a step back because it can be crazy, as I'm learning now. I saw the advertisement for the first one and I missed it. And then I saw the advertisement for the second one and I missed it because I had work, and I convinced myself for this third one I'm going to book it months in ahead. And asked if I wanted to volunteer, and I said, well, I've got the whole day off anyway, so here I go. And by the end of the conference, of course, I'd been interested before coming to University of Toronto in drug policy and advancing research in cannabis, psychedelics, and stimulants. And it seemed like a really obvious way to get involved. And since then, it's been, I guess, probably since the Mushrooms Conference, 2 months. And then I became director because Dan wanted to take a step back from being director, and I've quickly found myself facilitating talks from Robin Carhart-Harris on psychedelics, on microdosing. We had a really exciting seminar symposium in February, because the other thing that I've realized in the past year is that there's a ton of research that's being done that isn't getting translated to the public, whether that's cannabinoid research, which people aren't talking about in reference to cannabis, or whether that's lots of psychedelic research that's not being done with psilocybin or LSD, so you're not finding it on those Wired articles the same way.
Yeah.
Because an article on DOI and mice from 1980 isn't as, I don't know, sexy or exciting. But
yes, absolutely.
But we're starting, I guess, to look back through those papers as we're suggesting maybe we can use psilocybin or MDMA or cannabis as therapies. What are they doing?
So taking a step back, were you interested in what you are now, as in drug policy and psychedelics, before you started your degree, or because of the movement in your degree at University of Toronto?
Yes, I would. I got involved in... Yeah, no, I started... I always had an interest in biochemistry, and when I was in high school, I started smoking weed, and a lot of my friends, because I had that interest in biochemistry, I knew a lot about the drugs. I checked Arrowhead. I was very conscientious about my drug use. And my friends were not. So they quickly started asking me questions that really their doctors should have been answering at the time. Here's my medication. Should I be mixing this with this? I found these straight. And I suddenly realized how much of a need there was for even a standardized type of study for these kinds of drugs, for this kind of drug use. And so it became a really salient and interesting point to me that for drugs that we, even if we are, you know, take the FDA assumption that these drugs are not useful, we don't even really understand the harms of them very well. So that got me interested. And then when I went to Toronto, I had that in mind, got interested in pharmacology, got interested in neuroscience. And I started to discover how much research was being done that people would just didn't seem to know about because, like I said before, it's not well translated or it's not, you don't have the person saying maybe this drug can be a promising lead for something like epilepsy that people really aren't thinking of when they think of something like psychedelics.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel that that's almost a similar story for my like awakening, so to speak, into a drug policy world, because it was when I went to university because I did chemistry in my undergrad, and that was learning about all different drugs, and it was surprising to me to learn about cocaine, heroin, you know, the big original illicit drugs, and being taught about them without any sort of political swing. It was really refreshing to go, oh
yeah, you don't have to have a preamble of drugs are bad and no one should take them. It's just like, no, there's so much research being done.
And I feel in the psychedelic community as well, there certainly seems to be, not even necessarily, that though there also is certainly people who take the drugs and are very impressed by them, but research, a lot of people coming from the cognitive science, from the neuroscience background, who are saying, even if we aren't, again, irrespective of the drug's usefulness as medicine, there's something clearly profound happening in the brain, and this is a very useful tool for learning about how the brain does things like predict reward, determine long-term versus short-term futures, that kind of thing. So yeah, there's a lot of, and we're working towards getting some of that research done, hopefully, and that'll be exciting.
Okay, great. So I guess, yes, let's move on to, start us off with some psychedelic chat.
Just for sake of ease, restrict psychedelics to drugs which agonize the 5-HT2A receptor.
Okay.
So this, broadly speaking, is referring to LSD, psilocybin. I guess in a true psychedelic sense, think of psilocybin, LSD, and drugs which are working in the same brain system. Mescaline would be the other one.
Mescaline. And what about, let me think, just thinking, what's like, DMT, is that involved as well?
So DMT is a very effective, most of these drugs are derivatives or similar to the serotonin molecule. I guess to give examples of drugs which people often think of as psychedelic that I would call not truly, ketamine is not a true psychedelic, it's a dissociative, it's an anesthetic. PCP is a dissociative anesthetic. And delirience, so if somebody's, I don't know, huffing paint or something, this isn't giving them a psychedelic effect.
Yeah.
And most notably in a lot of these drugs which are, psychedelics are not inducing a delusional experience. If you see somebody who's high on oil or high on, they think that they're in places that they're not, they are clearly out of touch with their environment. It's like somebody having a dementia or psychosis.
Right.
Where people with psychedelics can actually show a remarkable ability to realize where they are, who they are, etc. They just also feel these intense feelings of euphoria, visual patternings, feeling of oneness, etc.
Yeah. Okay. Just to touch on the ketamine thing, I feel that there's a movement in classing ketamine with psychedelics because of the movement of trying to use it in for therapeutic settings, for depression, etc. Just at the same time as psilocybin and MDMA are being used or being explored in those ways, that I feel that that's, it's because it's an illicit drug and it's going within that movement. I feel that people are just going, oh yeah,
lump it all together. And they both, and I mean from a third person observer, if I'm talking to somebody who knows little or nothing about drugs, I'll say, oh, well, mushrooms, I'll eat some mushrooms and then I'll trip and hallucinate for a few hours, whereas I'll, snort some ketamine and then I'll trip and hallucinate for a few hours. To a person who doesn't have a lot of experience, there may not subjectively be a lot of difference, even if any user can tell you that ketamine and mushrooms are profoundly different drugs and probably working in different ways. There's a recent study, or I saw it was like Wired or somebody writing about it, where they were trying to use nasal ketamine.
Okay.
To get the same results as they've been doing in the ketamine clinics. And it doesn't work.
Okay.
And the patients feel disoriented, they feel wonky, they feel like, if somebody's recreationally using ketamine, and they don't not feel, they can't test for the antidepressant effects because they feel like crap afterwards. And similarly, there's some animal studies that are looking at norketamine, and it looks like it may actually be the breakdown byproducts of ketamine that are the antidepressants and not the trip, if you will. Whereas with the psychedelics like mushrooms, LSD, etc., it's much more likely that the trip and the curative experience aren't actually separable from each other.
Okay. That's interesting.
Yes.
Okay, and which psychedelics are being looked at for epilepsy?
So, and it's a bit of a misnomer, and I guess to give the long story on it, back around 2008, there was some research again at U of T, and I've talked to Dr. Bercovici, who did some very interesting work with Dravet syndrome. And Dravet syndrome, to provide context, and more broadly, it's called atypical absence epilepsies.
Okay.
So they're catastrophic epilepsies of childhood. Around 1 to 2 years of age, they start having infantile spasms, and they are severely cognitively disrupted. They never develop fully, often having excess of 30 seizures a day. These are very severe cases. Now, it's similar to absence seizures, which people may have heard of, where the person, guess I can't show it on the podcast, but the person had his zones out for a second. Mm-hmm. Some kids grow out of these, but obviously some do not. So having and getting drugs for these atypical cases is very important because right now not much works. Now, one of the things that we are using presently is a drug called fenfluramine, which is a serotonin releaser all over your body. It releases all the serotonin. And it works, but it has a lot of side effects, namely cardiac side effects. You have a lot of serotonin 2B receptors in the heart. Mm-hmm. And if you activate if you activate a whole bunch of receptors in the heart of any sort, it's probably not going to be doing great things.
Yeah.
I, not being a cardiologist, taking a wild swing at it, that's what I've heard. So what they did is they said, if we're releasing serotonin to stop the epilepsy, maybe we should see which serotonin receptor is being activated. They found that particularly the agonists of the 2A, which was, I think, their study used DOI, which some people have probably heard of as a psychedelic amphetamine derivative. DOI stopped the seizures.
Okay.
And the animals go from, they have the, EEG that's up and down, up and that looks like an animal having a seizure. Or actually, it's a spike wave discharge. It's kind of different with absence epilepsy. And the animals stopped seizing. And that was the end of that study. And then I think in most recently in the States, what they're doing is they did a study with Danios-Dravet syndrome, showed that it worked, and they tried a drug called lorcaserin. Knowing this, I'll put that on pause for a second to explain lorcaserin, because lorcaserin is something I'm really excited about, which I'm really hoping gets approved in Canada, and I have no disclosures of the company that makes it. Hasn't been paying me, though maybe they should be.
By saying you love it so much. What is this drug?
So lorcaserin is a drug they've approved in the United States for the treatment of obesity, to reduce appetite, and it's a 5-HT2C agonist.
Right.
It happens to also have a decent amount of affinity for the 5-HT2A receptor.
And these, are serotonin receptors.
Yes, the serotonin 2A and 2C receptors, which, as the name implies, they're very similar.
Yeah.
It's been suggested that they have reversing potentials, or that one is counterbalancing the other, but it seems that the serotonin 2C agonists that don't have any 2A activity aren't getting through trials.
Right.
And this one, which does have 2A activity, was helping people lose weight and wasn't having any severe side effects.
Huh.
So in the United States, they've approved it for weight loss, and they found that these people were smoking less, too. So now they're looking at it for smoking cessation.
Right.
And I'm looking at this saying, these kinds of habit-changing behaviors are kind of similar to what psychedelic therapy is probably.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
And unsurprisingly, this 2A activity means that if you were to take a lot of lorcaserin, don't do this, by the way, if you do manage to find it. The reports also say that it feels awful, but it seems to be have psychedelic activity just at very low, much lower doses. Huh. So nobody's tripping on this drug, but it seems to be activating that same receptor system and getting a lot of the same benefits. So because this is an approved drug you can use in people, coming back to epilepsy, they tried it in a case study with 5 case studies, and it seemed to be a well-received drug. But what it looks like is what it is, which is not a very good 5-HT2A agonist. So what I wonder and would love to see studies on, obviously we're a long ways off, but if you were to get something like DOI or psilocybin or LSD, like a really good 5-HT2A agonist, we might be onto something. Now, I want to say this with a deal of caution if we're including this, because I don't want parents with kids with epilepsy to go out and get their...
Yeah, absolutely.
Particularly, and Sophia Korb mentioned with autism, there can be a degree of parents want to try anything to help their kid.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why I'm very apprehensive. So, you know, LSD does not cure epilepsy. It's just, for some seizure disorders, this may be a very promising lead.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very easy to demonstrate when a kid's having 30 seizures a day and you give him a drug and he goes down having one seizure a week. And it looks like you can get this kind of efficacy for LSD with some kinds of seizures.
Okay.
So to me, it seems silly to overlook that research. And hopefully in the States, mm-hmm. whether through lorcaserin in the sideways way, or if somebody's going to...
And is lorcaserin a psychedelic?
The company that makes it is arguing very hard that it is not.
Is that because, for...
Which I suspect is for legal reasons.
Right, got you.
But it is scheduled in the United States. So mm-hmm. if you have it without a prescription, it is illegal.
Right.
Because they're worried about the 5-HT2A could possibly be hallucinogenic. And it looks like when they did abuse liability testing, people found high doses unpleasant.
Mm-hmm.
But people also... One of the side effects can be hallucinations.
Okay. I guess there's...
Don't even think good. But you know, like when if you take high doses and then it's pleasant and yes. then you get hallucinations,
yes.
that's probably bad because yes. then that is, you know, abuse liability. But if yes. you actually take quite a lot and it is bad, it's quite a, you know, I guess a safety net of you don't want to yeah. have it.
Yes,
that
bigger. And what's been and what for the psychedelics has been a running issue is, so I mentioned the serotonin 2A and the serotonin 2C receptors, which are both in your brain and have a whole lot of very important functions in your
yeah.
brain. And are probably how psychedelics are working their magic or whatever. But you also have the 5-HT2B receptor, and you have those in your heart, as I mentioned before, and you have a lot of them in your heart. So a lot of non-specific ones can induce something like the thickening of a cardiac valve,
okay.
which has not been definitively linked to cardiac problems, but especially when you're talking about using a drug to help obese smokers, cardiac risk is very relevant.
Yes, absolutely.
And in lorcaserin, it also, because again, it's a very dirty serotonergic drug, it also has that 5-HT2B affinity.
Mm.
So people, there is concern that people using high doses, it's far from an ideal drug, but it seems to be coming through the pipeline, and
yeah.
it's definitively proven to work, and we can give it to humans in trials already.
Okay.
So in that sense, it's very promising, and I'm surprised that I haven't seen more connecting it with the microdosing scene.
Yeah, that is interesting. Can I just ask, you know, with the... what you were looking at with epilepsy and psychedelics within that, have any human trials been done, or is this working off animal trials?
This is all working off animal
trials.
Lorcaserin is the only psychedelic or pseudocyte that there's any kind of human
right.
getting, even right now in for alcoholism or smoking cessation studies where the people coming in are more or less healthy normals.
Yeah. Can I just ask you, because we've spoken about microdosing, but I've realized that we haven't explained what that is.
Oh, yes.
So could you explain to me what microdosing
yes.
is, please?
So microdosing. So microdosing, I guess, was a concept that started, correct me if I'm, or if you've heard of it before, but probably around 2010, 2011 or so, 2012, a lot, or some of it was in association with the research chemical scene that had started, which... but where you've had, I guess, a new psychedelic renaissance. The Rolling Stone wrote an article about microdosing in Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, it was like one guy who was taking low doses of LSD, because I don't know, he was a crazy guy in Silicon Valley, I guess. And Rolling Stone published it. And suddenly, all of Rolling Stone's reader base, who are, I assume, reasonably progressively minded, if you're picking up
yeah.
something, you know, that says the new phenomenon of microdosing LSD in Silicon Valley. And people started trying it. And it's kind of weird because retrospectively, we can it's obvious to say, why wouldn't we just try a dose that's sub-psychedelic?
So
it seems to be a growing and more and more widespread phenomenon.
Yeah, and great. Right, I'm trying to explain this from what I remember with the articles, but what I'm thinking is it's like a typical dose that's split up in over a week or over more than that and take it once every few days.
Yes.
Is that correct?
So yeah. a bunch of different... And one of the issues that we've been having in the field, not just in microdosing, but psychedelics in general, I guess, is there's not a very consistent protocol. James Fadiman seems to be working out the most popular, or probably the best one, which is that every third day, instead of taking a psychedelic dose, you're taking a substantially sub-psychedelic dose. I've heard anywhere between on the lower end 1 or 2 micrograms, on the higher end 10 or 15. But it seems the principle is that you are taking enough that your perception is not notably altered, but your mood, etc., cognition, etc., can be enhanced or uplifted or what have you. Most notably or most interestingly, what they seem to be discovering is that the day of is only part of the effect. So where what they expected, I guess, was, or were worried about, was people taking, you know, a bit feels good, take more and more until they start having problems with it. Instead, what they find is it's people take less over time. Okay. They started with dosing every other day, and they found that it was the people who were sending them the information cut back to every third day.
Huh.
And it's okay. The third day that they start to really feel that enhanced creativity, that enhanced social flow. So there's a big need in cannabis and psychedelics for there to be a more standardization in this respect. But on the other hand, what we're seeing, again, in both cannabis and psychedelic research, is a large amount of variability. And I think that's going to be a struggle for us in coming, because let's say we're trying to do something like microdosing. A major side effect is going to be you're going to have somebody that's particularly sensitive. As we know, for example, people who have had early stress, so drug addicts, people who you are relevant treatment populations, may be dramatically more or dramatically less responsive. And figuring out stuff like dose response, our current model of drug development and pharmacology is just not very well suited to it.
Yeah.
Well, I hope that the more this, you know, cannabis becoming legal in Canada will open a lot more doors for research.
Yes.
So hopefully that will flow on to psychedelics.
It looks like probably the three flagships that we've had in Canada. Cannabis has been one because obviously, you know, in terms of having a legality framework, in one of your other podcasts, one of your guests was mentioning how much of a headache it can be getting a legal framework for each successive drug. So cannabis is one. MDMA seems to be another. There's a lot of new research cropping up here. Ann Wagner at Ryerson University is doing couples therapy with MDMA.
Because that's what they used to use MDMA for couples therapy ages ago, wasn't it?
Yes.
Because it's empathogen, meaning it makes you feel lovely and that you love everybody. And
you're willing to open up and your fear centers shut off and those deep-seated memories come flowing through you. And it can be quite wonderful. And I think recent years, our government or world governments have been more accepting of at least the therapeutic opportunity.
Yeah.
I'm hearing it. There seems to be some research in Europe. There's research in Canada. Research in the States is a bit more tentative with the political situation there, of course. But
there's just so much. I think we'll round up now because we've covered a lot of topics. We've done a lot.
Yes.
So, thank you for joining me, Will. And speak to you soon.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And that was our interview with Will Bastido. I hope you enjoyed it. If you're interested in the CSSDP, check out the Canadian Students for Sensible Drug Policy's work online and follow them on Twitter. And follow us on Twitter while you're at it. We have a new email address, which is whatsthecrackpodcast@gmail.com. So holler us there. See you next time.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.